Before we get going, here's the bit where I remind you that nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets. And now, on with the show. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of the Grant Williams podcast. This is likely the very last one of the year. So before we get into my conversation today, a big thank you to you all out there for listening to me and for supporting me through this year. It's been a wild year, and I'm incredibly grateful to all my guests for coming on and sharing their wisdom with me throughout this last 12 months. And I suspect that what we're going to be confronted with in the next 12 months has the potential once again to make the last 12 look like a cakewalk. It's been like that for the last several years. And my guest today is going to confirm a lot of those thoughts with me. I'm going to be talking to Michael Oliver of Momentum Structural Analysis. You know, Michael's work first came on my radar screen about 8 years ago, and it was unlike anything I'd really seen before. It's technical analysis, but the way Michael and his team do things in terms of looking at momentum rather than price really just spoke to me straight off the bat. And I was curious and keen to look at it, and what I found when I did in terms of its accuracy and its ability to look through the noise of price, which is something that I spend a lot of time trying to force myself to do, and look at the underlying momentum factors, it paints a very, very different picture of what has become a very familiar set of patterns in stock markets. And so I'm always thrilled to get a chance to talk with Michael about how he sees the world, and that's exactly what we're going to do. We're going to talk about the last year, and we're going to talk about what Michael sees coming in 2024. And as I say, his work has been extraordinarily prescient in terms of predicting big breaking points, both upwards and downwards, in a lot of different asset classes. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Michael Oliver. Michael, my friend, welcome back to the podcast. It's always a joy to get a chance to see you and to talk to you.
It's always great to be with you, Grant.
We've been through this procession of crazy years in markets, each one for a different reason. You know, we had the pandemic year of 2020. We had the craziness of 21. We had a wild year in 22. And this year has been just nuts. You know, I saw a chart today showing that given everything that's happened this year, the yield on the 10-year is back to where it was at the beginning of the year, which just shows you all the kind of Sturm und Drang that we've gone through really amounts to nothing. So I'm really happy to get a chance to talk to you primarily about this year, but also I'm looking forward to digging into some thoughts that you have for next year, because you wrote a piece recently which scared the bejesus out of me, frankly, and I'm not easily scared with such things these days. So let's, if we can, start with a kind of retrospective, Michael, and give us a sense of what you think has happened this past year, the important things that have happened, and how they perhaps set us up for what's to come in 2024.
It's a good question, because so many people, when they think about what's going to happen, they look at data points down the road as they unfold. Like today, we just had a couple data points come up. Big deal. Okay. But what's happened in the past often will determine what happens in the future, or shape it largely. And we've had a dozen-year stock market bubble in the U.S. market from 2009 to 2021. Now, most markets aren't even back near their peak trades that occurred usually in late 2021. Now, the S&P and NASDAQ are, but think about that 12 years. There's never before in the history of the U.S. stock market been one of such age, two of such multiples. We took the S&P from 2009 low to 2021 high sevenfold. NASDAQ 100 went up 16-fold. You go back and look at the 29 high, the highs in the early 70s, or the 2000.com high, or the 2007 real estate high, and measure those highs in relation to the bear market low that preceded them. You don't come up with anything comparable to a sevenfold, much less a 16-fold move. Well, you could say, well, you know, it's because the U.S. economy is real strong and, you know, blah, blah, blah. Well, yeah, right. Okay, look at an M2 chart and see the amount of printing they did over that decade compared to other decades of massive destruction of the money unit. And then look at the interest rates were effectively at zero, theoretical zero, for most of those dozen years. People make mistakes when that happens. It's like getting a drug stuck in your arm and, you know, you get hallucinogenic and you believe things that aren't real. And then you make decisions and suddenly you find out later, gee, that wasn't based on reality, because one of the biggest blocks of our reality in terms of financial planning of a family or a company or anything, is the price of money. Well, if they tell you it's free, and that's true for a decade or so, then you start to believe it, okay? And you make mistakes. These aren't data points. These are family by family, corporation by corporation, and they're inlaid into your future because as the planks start to snap because they were based on false assumptions, all kinds of things happen and has nothing to do with what's coming tomorrow. It's what already happened. That's where we are, I think. And I just think that the stock market, which is the prime beneficiary this time around of that monetary inflation, sometimes it's other things like commodities, like the late 1970s, for example, whose commodities and gold benefited. Stocks didn't. They were a wasteland. This time around, investors plowed all that free money into the stock market, and they got delusional. You could be a, quote, experienced money manager right now, being having been around, 10, 12 years, let's say, and still be living under those delusions that, you know, all that matters is the Fed. Well, anyway, so that's the problem we have now, is the unwinding of these errors in ways that aren't measured by government statistics. Snap, snap, snap. And suddenly big snaps, you know, some bank, major corporations, et cetera. That's what's happening. It's starting to happen. It's going to happen a lot more next year. And that, I think, is what explains our analysis of the market, which is not based on looking at a simple price chart. It's based on the long-term trend momentum of the market measured against long-term moving averages. So that we don't look at a price chart and a moving average. We look at the price in relation to above or below that average, and we oscillate it. And when you do that, you come up with a visual picture of reality that isn't necessarily and often is different from the price chart reality. And 90% of the time, momentum is going to be right and price is going to be wrong if they deviate. So that's where I think we are. Lovely year 2024. Going to be great.
When I first came across your work, I guess 8 odd years ago now, I was just blown away by how intuitive it was to me, particularly in an age where momentum has been everything, to look at prices the way you guys do. And you gave us a brief primer there, but I'm going to ask you, even though we've done this before on the podcast, there'll be people that perhaps haven't heard that. But I'm going to ask you, if you can, to give people a brief primer, because as you say, what you come up with are charts that look completely different to the shape of the price charts. And I think that confuses a lot of people, but we have been in this period where momentum has been everything, you know, the buy the dip period where everything has been about momentum. And so the work that you guys have done at MSA, to me, has been extraordinarily important in terms of understanding what's really going on away from the price. So if you can, before we dig into 2024, just give people a bit of a sense once again of just how you build those charts, how you measure momentum, and what those charts are actually telling people.
The term momentum that's popularly used is, it's going up and therefore it has, quote, momentum. Okay, well, quite often that's not the case. In other words, the price chart might look like it has, quote, momentum. But if you measure it versus some long-term mean, long-term averages, for example, we tend to emphasize longer term and intermediate term. A lot of people like to look at day-to-day. Okay, that's fine, but, you know, that's micro-reality. For instance, we measure the S&P or the NASDAQ or any major index, Shanghai Composite. We measure them versus certain long-term moving averages, like a 36-month or a three-year average. 36-month, you know, it changes every month, but it covers the last 3 years. That's the average price of the last 3 years. The gear shifts a little bit each month. Or three-year average, where at the end of each year, you get a new three-year average. You take that average, and then you simply plot, let's say, the monthly high, low, and close of price in its relationship to that average. So you're either above it or you're below it, right? And when you plot it, you get an oscillator. Doesn't look like the price chart. So, for example, over the last dozen years or so, the U.S. stock market in general has held above its 36-month average. You have a sell-off here, and then a couple of years later, another sell-off and another sell-off. And the price lows aren't the same. They're generally rising, and you can't even plot a trend line between them hardly because there might be curved. But when you look at momentum, there's this floor. You just keep coming down to it. Well, in most cases, what happened in 2022 broke that floor. So you broke the backbone of your structure, your momentum structure. And although price didn't take out some prior major low, momentum blew out umpteen prior momentum lows, oscillator lows. So structurally speaking, when you look at price, you say, well, just another dip. And you look at momentum, say, golly, just blew the floor out of this thing. Now, the problem was in 2022 that it took a lot of distance on the momentum chart to drop from the highs of the year down to breaking levels on the way down. There wasn't just one level you broke on momentum, but two or three. And finally blowing out, like the NASDAQ 100 blew out all the low closes going back to 2010. In fact, even the 2020 March low, remember that crash, the COVID crash, even that monthly close on the NASDAQ 100, which is our quote leader index, it was up 16-fold in the last 12 years. Its low monthly close in March, it scooted back up after that sell-off in March and closed just above the three-year average and the 36-month average. Like, oops, oh, I'm okay. So if you just look at the monthly closes and you ignore all the noise in between, you have this floor on the NASDAQ. It goes back a dozen years, or had the floor. And then in early 2022, we put out a sell signal. We said, okay, that's it. You're making your top. Now, what happened after that was a pretty serious drop. It was in layers in the summer, and then we rallied, and we came down in October, made a low. But in that process, NASDAQ blew out all those low oscillator readings of the prior dozen years. Price didn't, but momentum said, I'm broken. Now, just because you're broken doesn't mean you can't have a good rally. You know, no market goes from Z to A or A to Z in one shot. And we warned that the first leg of the bear market would likely be what we called arm wrestling. Boy, has it been. You go up, you go down, you go up, you go down. You know, people are confused. It's arm wrestling. It's sort of balanced. And because of the distortion in the S&P and the NASDAQ 100, by distortion, I mean, you take the first five stocks in those indices, and they explain the entire movement of the index. The rest of the stocks aren't even, you know, near their 2022 highs, but, you know, Apple and Amazon or Apple and Microsoft and so forth are. And they have such heavy weighting that the index, quote unquote, is up trading around its highs. But momentum isn't. We ran a recent chart on NASDAQ 100 annual momentum. And when you looked at the momentum chart going back, you know, to 2009 low, this whole rally this year looks pathetic. On the momentum chart. On price, it looked, you made a new high. Okay. Anyway, so that's what we look at. We could take that down timescale-wise. Let's say we're not concerned about the major trend. Maybe we're concerned about what's going to happen the next three, 4 months. And so we focus in on lesser yardsticks, like instead of a three-year average, maybe a three-month average. And we plot the momentum accordingly, and it gives us a view of what's likely to happen or the trigger points that might signal a move up or down. And right now, I'll give you a freebie. Based on quarterly momentum, which is measuring versus a three-quarter moving average. So that's close to what? Like a 200-day, right? 200-day, three quarters, okay. We oscillate the S&P and the NASDAQ versus that. I'm going to tell you right now, the S&P is trading 4,700 plus. Got up to near its highs within a quarter point, a quarter percent of its 2022 high, I think. Didn't matter one way or the other whether it took it out or not. You better not see that index waddle back off to around 4,400 anytime next year, especially not in the first quarter. Now, that's not a big drop. We've had like 7 or 8, 10 to 20% swings in the S&P over the last, in 2022 and 2023, just up and down, you know, 10 and 20% swings. So it's normal exhale, inhale. You can't drop back 5, 6, 7% now. You're going to start blowing structures, in which case it's telling us that, no, we're not near the low of 2022, which is 3,500. We're not low, near the low of the recent low that preceded this, which is down around 4,100. So the price charts say, hey, we're safely above those. You go to momentum, you don't want to see anything around 4,400 because you can start blowing that stuff out. And which tells us the bear trend that we called early in 2022 is resuming.
And this wasn't unexpected for you. You know, as I said, you said there was going to be arm wrestling. The thing that's always fascinated me about your work, this momentum analysis, is that because you have these long structures, it's as close as I've seen to tea leaf reading, because you get a really good view at the future. You can see what's coming, and you can see the levels at which things start to matter, and you can watch them shift in real time. You know, as those back numbers roll off and the new numbers come in, you know, when you put your pieces out and you say, look, here's what's going to happen next month. Here's where the average is going to be next month. And so this is the future number that we need to look for. It's fascinating to me. And so when you look at what your oscillators are telling you, what are the crucial structures? Is it S&P and NASDAQ? Are there structures in the bond market? Are there other structures that people really need to be paying attention to that perhaps the price charts will fool them into thinking are okay?
Yeah, well, right now, more than probably any time in my life, and I started in this market stuff in 1975 when gold was legalized. So I've been around a while. So in the future side of the business up to 92 and we started MSA. The tectonic plates of this asset category, that asset category, sometimes they don't seem to correlate well, and sometimes they don't, you know, okay. But one of them does now is likely to impact another one. Like, for instance, right now, our big bet would be a rollover in the stock market will exacerbate and reveal all these wounds that are under the surface. So when that market rolls over the next time, and like I said, you could add about 4,400 anytime next year, kiss it goodbye, you're going down, okay? At that point, all of a sudden, the data points are going to start to shift. They never lead a market. You go back and look at major data points, look at a top or look at a bottom, they hardly told you. It was later they joined it. But anyway, when you roll that asset category over and things related to it, like real estate, which is moving with it, except it's down huge on the year, and the bond market, for example, you start to jeopardize those asset categories and throw people's mindsets into panic. Because see, they've been comforted by this last 2 years. Actually, they shouldn't have been, because if only if you're in the S&P 500 or NASDAQ are you comforted. Most sectors aren't even near. Most of them are 10 or 20% away from their highs. But anyway, it's when that asset category starts to sink more visibly, noticeably, emotionally. That's when you start to get the wave effects that will cause the central bank to go berserk, back the other way, the way they normally go. Print, 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 whatever it takes to save the paper empire. And I think that's what gold's known all this time. Because you look around the world and say, oh, what asset category is making all-time new highs? Why does it keep coming back to its all-time new highs? Gold. It's hard to find one. Look at the Shanghai Composite. Look at most U.S. indexes or sectors. They're nowhere near the 2021, 2022 highs. But our bonds, T-bonds, gee, back in 2020, we said sell bonds in October. They're collapsed versus that price. Try to find an asset that's held its value. And why has it done that? Because it knows. I think it knows what's coming. And it's the tectonic plate movement of especially the stock market.
I just wrote about gold a couple of weeks ago, because I think exactly the same thing. It feels to me like there's a lot of information, not necessarily in the gold price per se, but again, you know, you look at momentum as an underlying way to really understand what's happening in something. And I think with gold, it's the action, it's the resilience in the face of the kind of factors that would normally send gold plunging. It's held up remarkably well. And there is definitely a message. If you go back through time, there are plenty of periods in the past where we've seen gold send a message like this. So what does the structure underneath gold look like right now to you?
Well, it's actually the structure overhead.
Yes.
Back in 2011, we made a high, $1,920. 2 months later, January 2012, we went major bearish. And yet price just had another dip. It was no big deal. You had plenty of dips along the way. But annual momentum broke a trend structure that a kid with a crayon could have drawn. Not on the price chart, but on the momentum. You say, hey, there's a line here and it keeps coming back to it. You know, and it finally broke it and that was it. In 2013, the market crashed. It got cut in half, nearly 2,000 down to 1,050. Okay, February 2016, there was an overhead structure. Meaning when you looked at price chart, it was like this, staircase down. It already crashed in spring of 2013, but the final year or so was just arm wrestling stuff. Okay, downside, downside. When it upticked into the 1100s, specifically around 1140, meaning 90 bucks off the low, an annual momentum chart blew out a ceiling that, again, a kid with a crayon could have seen on momentum, annual momentum, not on price. And boy, it went from there to 1350 so fast it made your head spin. Okay, that was its first inhale. Okay, since then, we've had this upward process. And yes, we've stalled in price 2050, 2050, 2050 for three times, 2020, 2022, and early this year. And finally, we punched through it a few weeks ago, and they got selling up there from the BIS, but it's coming back up again. But its real structures, momentum structures, are already broken out to the upside. So there's not really something you need to break out through on momentum. You're rating now on the lagged factor, price. Usually momentum speaks first, and then price says, oh, okay, I'm going to join you. And so I think we're starting to see that even in price, where gold has gone up, is now pushing at to try to close a month out well over those old highs of the last several years. But we got a week to go, and we're trading at 2080. So we're actually, right now, you're trading actually price-wise above all those highs. They were all 2070 something. But and silver's doing sort of the same thing, except its pattern, you can look at its price chart. It had been in a downtrend channel. Now, momentum has already broken out on silver, same as gold, okay? But silver always acts like a dog during most of any monetary metal bull market. You go back and look at the early 70s to 1980. Look at the move from 2000 to 2011. All massive bull markets in gold. There was a point late in each of those bull trends where silver, being sort of a sloppy participant, you know, sometimes it beat gold for a couple of months and then it pulls back. But it generally tags along with gold. It's in that last year of the aged bull market when silver goes absolutely ape, goes berserk. I think we're at that point right now. I think we're very near that point where silver is going to grow a backbone. And while gold punches through all these highs, you get back over $26 right now on silver, for example. Even the price guys are going to say, oh, we've hit that three times in the last 2 years. I better get long. Momentum says already be long. But it's at that point, I think you'll probably get a huge inflow of new money into that sector and the gold miners too. We're watching this very closely.
Well, I wanted to come onto those actually, because you put out a piece just in this last week, I think it was, about the gold mining stocks. So talk a little bit about them, because your description of silver is apposite when we talk about the mining stocks, and they seem to do this on steroids. You know, they do nothing at all until people really believe in a rally in precious metals. People believe that if we break through this 2100 level that's become so kind of fearsome on the price charts, even though your momentum charts say we're already through, there's an enormous amount of catch-up that tends to happen in these mining stocks. So what do the momentum structures tell us about the GDX, the GDXJ, which I know you look at?
Well, we look at those, and especially in their relationship to gold. And in fact, a lot of people lose track of this. Yes, the miners have vastly underperformed gold since they made their surge high in 2020. They went into a protracted decline, whereas gold more or less went sideways. And so they were dogs. But if you actually measure them, even take Newmont, the biggest blue chip of all, was at $90 and it dropped down here, you know, whatever. It collapsed over the last year and a half in price. But if you look at where it is right now in price and go back and look at its bear low in 2015, it's up like 160%, whereas gold's only doubled. So yes, it's had a big exhale, but it's still in an investment grade perspective, you know, the last 8 years, it's still beating gold. But we think it's about to reassert itself, and the miners in general are. What we do is we measure on a spread basis. How does GDX look relative to gold? When you divide GDX into gold, you get a certain percent, right? Okay, you plot that, just like a price chart. In fact, it is, because you're measuring price of one versus price of another. But then we run momentum studies of that, and I'm saying right now that already over the last month or two, I've seen enough positive shift by the miners on a relative performance basis to indicate that they're about to resume another leg of outperform. Same with silver. Silver's very near levels where if you go up just a little bit more on percent basis, silver versus an ounce of gold, you're going to break it out over relative performance charts. Now, what does that mean? Well, it means it's better to be there than in gold. Yeah, gold's the mama, but the little dogs will outpace it again. Well, what's interesting is historically in those old bull markets, that's when silver especially goes berserk. So not only is it likely that silver could outperform gold and the miners, but we're already ended year 8 of the bull market. 2015 low, end of 2023. It's 8 years of upside in gold. And if you go back and look, the other bull markets last, you know, maybe 9-10 years. And it's in this last phase of those bull markets that you get the parabolic movement. And I think we're on the cusp of that right now.
Fascinating. Well, look, we said we talk about 2024 with that as backdrop, because we just keep having momentous year after momentous year after momentous year. And this year, as we look ahead to 2024, the previous few years, it's been difficult. No one saw the pandemic coming. No one saw a lot of the things that have happened. But this year coming, we have an event that we can all see, we can all look towards, and we can all try and rationalize and try and game. And that is obviously the US elections. And you put out a piece, I think last week, Tabula Rasa. And so I want to, if I can, give you the floor to talk about that, because this was really an uncharacteristic piece for you, you know, and I think this is something that we're not used to reading from you. And so whenever someone whose work I trust and whose work has proven to be really good comes out and says something that's a little off piece for them, I'm always paying attention, because I think they're the important things to realize. So walk us through this piece and tell us why it's so important.
Everybody knows that America is divided politically. Okay, fine. What does that mean? The problem is that we're reaching a point, not only economically, which is going to hurt people, Remember how people hurt in 2008 and 9, and yet that was only a double bull market from the 2002 low to the 2007 high. It was only a double. We'll get a sevenfold, 16-fold. So it's going to be bigger bubble, bigger breakage, more pain. But you start to inject that pain into the same year you've got this election, but people are already hurting. And the division in the two parties reflects, I think, the fragmentation of dysfunctional statism, meaning when everything gets done by government as opposed to market forces, whether you're a democratic country or not, it doesn't matter. The point is the government imposes its will and, you know, thinking from above instead of allowing everybody to do their own thinking on a micro level. Instead, all the rules come from above, in which case you have a regulated world. Well, it's dysfunctional. And some people realize that. They can't quite intellectually define it. Certain people in the past did, Ayn Rand being one and Murray Rothbard being another, but it's now coming to bear. I think all of this compressed error, like we were talking about the errors made by the notion of false money, for example, the false pricing of money, that creates errors. Well, errors get created and then pain comes. Well, it happens to be coincident with the election when we're maximally divided. And not only that, we're so divided that certain terms I've mentioned in several interviews over the last year, you got to start paying attention to words like secession. What? That was when I studied the Civil War. What do you mean? Well, on Texas, there's a thing on the ballot in 2024 that's been put forward to cause, if it gets enough positive votes, to cause the legislature to decide whether Texas should secede from the U.S. The fact that it's even on the ballot is amazing. Alaska just declared the legal tender of gold and silver. Whoa. That's in effect secession because you're saying, hey, Federal Reserve, your money ain't the monopoly money anymore. All these little things. There's a lot of counties throughout the country, Illinois, Oregon, so forth. Say, hey, we want to secede from this part of the state and join another state that's more like in line with us. That's commonplace now. So you're hearing these things pop up, but they don't make it on the national news, but they're there. University of Virginia Department of Politics did a survey. They're a neutral body. And pardon me, I'm going to pick up this piece of paper so I get it quoted right. This came out in October 18th of this year, so just recently. They did a poll of both Biden and Trump voters, likely voters. And so they come up with a lot of interesting observations. Majority of both Biden, 70%, and Trump voters, 68% of them, believed electing officials from the opposite party would result in lasting harm to the U.S. Well, you know, we know Democrats don't like Republicans, but never to this extent and lasting harm. Okay, now, two, roughly half, 52% of Biden, 47% of Trump voters, viewed those who supported the other party as threats to the American way of life. Whoa, 40% of both groups, 41% of the Bidens, 38% of the Trump voters, at least somewhat believed that the other side had become so extreme that is acceptable to use violence to prevent them from achieving their goals. Again, those percentages were 41% of the Biden people, if Trump got elected, and 38% of the Trump voters. Now, this may have changed a bit since October, but I bet it's gotten worse. Okay. Anyway, they also go on to mention the secession issues that are popping up here and there. For instance, it said roughly 2 in 5 of the respondents leaning toward Trump in 2024 at least somewhat agreed with the idea that red states secede from the Union to form their own separate countries. And 30% of Biden supporters expressed a similar sentiment for blue states. Whoa. Okay, now, this isn't being talked about on financial TV shows. You know, it's all earnings of this company or that nonsense data point that's a decimal different than what they thought it would be. That's their reality. It's like they're drugged or something. Now, this stuff's going on. This independent poll has numbers that are staggering. And now when you see editorials being written in major networks talking about, well, Trump's Hitler. Okay, well, you know, I guess if you're on the other side, that if he's Hitler, what do? Stay peaceful? No, of course not. And vice versa. So we're not taking sides. I'm just pointing out the underlying reality there. And our argument is there is no outcome of this election that will be copacetic, period. What does that mean for the solvency of the U.S. T-bond market? If the definition of what the U.S. government is changing, like suddenly it isn't, Texas isn't part of it. Everything else doesn't matter almost compared to this. And yet this isn't being talked about. I strongly suspect that well before the election, it will be talked about. There was probably in the first quarter sometime, we're going to have a reality out there that, hey, gosh, you know, what's the outcome here? There is not. And that becomes a dominant factor.
Yeah, Michael, it's interesting because I think you're right. This is not being talked about on a large scale. It's not being talked about on a public scale. But I've had these conversations privately in small groups with a lot of people. You know, a lot of people are genuinely concerned, the union, for the idea that the United States can hold together no matter who wins. And this is the big problem. It began as it's a never Trump thing. It began as we can't have Trump president again. But it's infected both sides. And both sides, as the poll data you just quoted bears out, both sides believe that the other is an existential threat to the preservation of the union. And, you know, I never thought I'd sit here and in my lifetime and be having conversations like this in a serious fashion. You know, it's interesting to game these ideas and think about them, but this is not some kind of pie in the sky idea. And whilst it's a long shot, and whilst it may not happen, to dismiss it based on the last 200 years of history and just say, well, it's just, you know, it's just not going to happen. People talk about it, but there's nothing to worry about, seems like whistling past the graveyard to me.
I think so. And I have a different view than you do. I think it's almost impossible to avoid it. I don't see a way out. Imagine if Trump loses. Let's say he gets the nomination, and right now the recent activity of the Colorado Supreme Court no doubt enhances his ability to get more votes in Iowa and in New Hampshire. They both come up in January 16th and January 23rd. So they come within less than a month, well before any Supreme Court decision might issue an opinion on that decision. So that's going to enhance him and therefore hurt Haley, for example, and or pull her numbers back down, in which case Trump's pretty much got the nomination wrapped up. Well, I mean, if that's the case, and the Democrats, doesn't matter who they pick, you know, it's going to be an interesting battle. And I do not see a way out that one side's going to say, oh, that's acceptable. I do not see it. Now, and then throw into the mix again what we argue about the markets and therefore real world pain associated with declining markets. The unemployment in 2008 and 2009 didn't come at 2007 top. And by the way, that's when the Fed cut rates. That's another interesting issue entirely. This talk about Fed softening that's the way the market topped in 2000. That's the way it topped in 2007. In fact, with rate cuts. And then it started to fall apart. But anyway, once that pain starts to come to the day-to-day life of people, then mix that in with this political as well, that enhances the passions, the negative passions. And I don't see any way around it, period. The only issue is, from an investor's point of view, what the heck do I do? What should I not be and what should I be careful of? And those are, I think, definable issues. And you need to start thinking about those because this variable is going to get tossed into the mix.
I agree that I, too, can't see a peaceful outcome of this election. I don't see a tranquil transition of power. My point is, whether we get all the way to secession or not, I'm not certain. But the very fact that it's a non-zero probability now is an extraordinary change in the landscape, right? Because it's been a demonstrable 0% probability for a couple of hundred years, right? And so we as humans struggle to adapt to changes like that. We can't conceive of them because they're bigger than all of our experiences. So a lot of people won't be able to even think about, well, you know, that's just nonsense. But as you say, these are the realities that we have to deal with. Whether you believe them or not, you cannot, I don't think, argue that there is still a 0% chance of some kind of secession somewhere and the breakup of the union. So let's come on to markets. As you said, you know, there are definable things here, and it's very difficult to come up with a bullish case for much other than perhaps gold in the event of such an outcome. So what are you thinking of this in market terms as you go through the analysis of the tabula rasa event?
Well, let's look at the T-bonds, you know, the 60-40 rule, 60% stocks, 40% bonds. You got a balanced portfolio. Well, 2022 killed those folks. S&P down 22%, NASDAQ down 30%, T-bonds down about 35% in price. Okay, so you got decimated on both sides of that, quote, balanced portfolio. So it sort of unlearned people about this supposed wisdom. However, in the recent decline in T-bonds, which started from early year highs this year, same time with gold. Gold made a high early in the year, so did T-bonds. They've got in sync with each other. You could look at weekly gold back then through about October and look at T-bonds. And they were trending the same way down. Gold was only incrementally pulling back. It didn't go back down to October low of the year before. It's 1600 area. It went down to low 1800s. But T-bonds went into a precipitous collapse. And we predefined that back in the summer. We said there's going to be a nuke event here. Technically speaking, we said it'd be a nuke break, a nuclear implosion. And sure enough, there was. There was a crash-type drop in the T-bonds. And if you looked at muni bonds at the same time or looked at high-yield corporate debt at the same time, they were weak, but they weren't crashing. It was the U.S. government bond that was literally looking like some commodity, limit down type stuff. No, joking, wasn't limit down, but it was extremely serious. And I knew at that point that the central bank, even though clearly this is not part of their incremental adjustments, this was an implosion, and it was beyond their control. But it's the most important asset category to them. You know, it's their world. Okay, they have to defend that market. So it didn't take any great logic on our part to know that, one, this V-bottom technically was going to create probably a V-bottom. In other words, you're going to collapse, but you're also a vertical. It's the nature of such bottoms. We could see that coming. So sure enough, we did it. About a month after gold turned up, T-bonds finally turned up, and they exploded nicely. So we called that event. But we're not bullish on bonds longer term. The longer term annual momentum picture actually turned negative a couple of years ago. Now, most people looking at yield charts, you know, which are been declining, there was like a multi-decade downtrend line, and we broke through it recently. Well, this pullback in yields isn't negating that breakout you had on the yield charts. It's just a pullback in what is now an uptrend in yields. The same when you look at price, it's the opposite. Price goes down, yields go up. Now we're having the price rally. I don't think it'll sustain. I think it's a nice trading rally. I think some large asset managers, no doubt, are saying, hey, this category got overdone. I'm going to push some more back in that 40% category. And they're right. They're going to make some money. They have. But I don't think in the long run it's going to sustain. Again, put yourself in a foreign investor's position, a large corporation buying bonds or a foreign government even. If suddenly it dawns on you that, gee, the American political outcome is looking more like some South American country, are you going to be jumping in and buying those bonds? Or are you going to be sitting on your hands? That's a variable. Well, anyway, that variable is the one that no doubt caused the Fed to finally say, okay, we're not going to raise anymore. In effect, that's what they did say, by the way. And market interpreters interpreted that way correctly. The only issue now that they debate is, when are they going to cut rates? Well, you know, all I can say is, if you're a stock market investor, you do not want to see the Fed even pause, much less cut rates. That doesn't seem logical. Go back and look at the 2000 peak, look at the 2007 peak. In 2000, the Fed had been raising rates up through May of 2000. Market had been rising. In July of 2000, they put out a report, didn't change rates, but it had a sentence in it. We ran a recent report that clearly was, oops, we're going to have to pause here because certain numbers are cooling off. And when the Fed says that, it's with intent. Okay, what happened right after that July report? The market shot up into August on the S&P, made a new high monthly close. We got bearish in January, warning that it could be sideways, January of 2000. But that Fed statement caused the buyers to jump in and have a Fed rally. If you'd have sold that rally, you sold the top. And in January of 2001, they began to cut rates aggressively and the stock market imploded all the way down. Same in 2007. You've been topping out all year. Late 2006, we said 2007 is the top year. Your likely top zone is 1550 to 1600. In September of 2007, the market was laboring near its highs. That's the S&P now. Most sectors like financials were on their lows. Okay, but S&P was near its highs. And the Fed cut rates by half a basis point. You had like a month plus rally into October. If you'd have shorted into that Fed cut rally, you shorted the top and they cut rates all the way down. So if the Fed now says we're going to pause and even says maybe next year we're going to start cutting rates, don't interpret that bullishly. History shows it means the Fed is worried about something. And I think one of the things they're worried about is their own bond market.
What impact has the massive rise of indexing had on these outcomes, on the momentum charts? Because obviously there's a constant momentum undertow now from passive indexing. Has that changed these structures at all visibly?
No, it hasn't, but I don't know how to define the impact of those products. I really don't have an opinion on that. It's no doubt homogenized a lot of the flows of money. You know, there's no question. But even when, you know, we just put out a report that was just a simple graph chart and not momentum, and just showed, okay, where on a graph chart, where was the S&P versus the highs of the late 2021, early 2022? And it was like 0.25% below zero, I mean, 0.5% below where it was back then. So it's been 2 years of wasting your time after we said sell, but everybody's cheering it. Okay, NASDAQ 100, about 0.5% above where it had been at its peak 2 years ago. But then when you look at all the other sectors, one exception being industrial and tech. Of course, we know tech is up there because that's what why the S&P is up there. So NASDAQ 100. But industrials, because very few symbols within the industrial ETF were making new highs. But they were weighted enough to, and they were exaggerated enough to cause the ETF to actually make a new high. But every other sector out there that you could name, communication services, anything related to consumer, retail, consumer staples, consumer discretionary, healthcare, you name it, it's well down versus its highs of 2021, 2022. So you look at those and look at the S&P and it's like two different worlds. So some of these ETFs that, you know, they do homogenize the flow of money into this sector or that, I can't quite define.
It's interesting because over the years, it used to be that the strength or otherwise of the stock market was a byproduct of the economy because the companies would do well or badly depending on economic conditions and the stock market would reflect that. But, you know, post Greenspan and through Bernanke and Yellen and now Powell, we've seen this massive shift to me, which I kind of understand, but I fear that it sets us up for, at some point, a massive washout. And that's this idea that, to your point about Fed cuts, that all that matters is the stock market. And what's good for the stock market is what we need to be cheering on. And what used to be good for the stock market was the economy. Now the economy doesn't matter. It's right. Rate cuts equal higher asset prices equal buy. And I think your point is so important to understand for people that when the cutting cycles begin, and you can look as far back as you want with this, the stock market tends to perform horribly in the next year or so. And that's just, and it makes perfect sense to me. But, you know, I posted something on Twitter the other day. You know, I looked at the chart of AMC, you know, the classic ape stock. And I talked about how depressing I find that chart. You know, we've seen the crazy rise and the stock's now back below where it was before all this stuff happened. And I talked about how depressed that chart made me and the fact that Adam Aron, the CEO, knew exactly what he was doing in terms of fleecing all these people that were willing to put, I'm using air quotes here, dumb money into this stock. And he took advantage of them. And the whole point of my tweet was to say, look, I feel bad for the people who got sucked in to that high thinking there's a new dawn here and we've got a great CEO and we're going to stick it to Wall Street and diamond hands and all this nonsense. And the reality is you're back down way below where you were at that time. And the response to that tweet has been eye-opening to me. You know, here I was expressing sympathy for the people who had been kind of sucked into this and had lost money. And the number of vitriolic replies to my tweet from people who were in this ape group, it really surprised me. You know, I was genuinely surprised that they either misunderstood the point of my message, which when I went back and read it was pretty clear. I don't think there was any ambiguity in what I wrote. And this mindset that has sucked in an awful lot of people that don't really understand how markets work and don't really understand how corporate finance works and don't really understand the credit stack and don't really understand liabilities and certainly don't really understand what a Fed cut means, to your point earlier on. There's an awful lot of money in these markets that will actually propel them higher and give Wall Street types the perfect bag holders as and when these rate cuts come to take advantage of them. Is there any way for you to, in your work, see the effect that this massive injection of stimulus, which has gone into the hands of people who are very much uneducated in the ways of the stock market, has impacted in the underlying momentum structures of these markets?
It varies, but it's really not an issue of them printing money or printing less money. I use that word broadly, print. You know, there's all kinds of mechanisms they use to do that. Okay, but it's usually an investor shift, a sentiment shift, large portfolio managers in particular, where they say, okay, it's been a joyous dozen years upside. And I've doubted this stock market over the last year or two, but I had to stay in it because, you know, I'm competing with guys who are already in it. So if I get out and it goes up, I lose on a relative basis. So they have to play the game, but they're also intellectually ready to jump ship. but they need to have vehicles that they can jump ship to that are orthodox enough to be acceptable to their investors. And gold miners would be one of them, especially the two big blue chips, you know, Barrick Gold and Newmont, for example. And that's why we're watching them very closely lately. But it's not an issue of the Fed printing more or printing less in this particular. It's where the investors put that river flow. It's a river of money, okay? But it always doesn't go to where the Feds want it to go. Obviously, they started cutting aggressively in 2001, all the way through the bear low in 2002. They didn't particularly want the stock market to crash. You know, NASDAQ went down like 80%, the dot-com. They didn't particularly want the 2007 cut, October, to yield a collapse down to the 600s on the S&P from 1570-something. They were trying to stop that, yet it didn't go to where they wanted it to go. It's not when they wanted it to go there. Oh, yeah, finally, S&P got down in the 600s, and some smart investors said, oh, okay, now I can see value here, less risk, more reward. But right now, I think most major asset managers see high risk, low reward in the stock market. The only problem is they need to find an alternative. And T-bonds certainly haven't been that alternative until, you know, a couple months ago. And so of the categories they're looking at out there, the subsectors within the market, they're acting like dogs compared to the S&P. And they know this. They know what's causing the S&P to be up here. It's five symbols. And so you can only own so much Apple and Microsoft, okay, you know, in your portfolio. And same with NASDAQ 100, where those weightings are double what they are in the S&P. So they're looking for a place to be. So even once the money flow again starts to flow down the stream, you know, more aggressively, it's not necessarily going to go where the Fed would like it to go. In fact, it usually doesn't go where they'd like it to go. Once something's broken, it takes over. There's a reality above and beyond the Fed. The Fed is not God. The Fed may help cause the boom bust cycles, but it isn't really the creator of good and so forth. So once they revert to a defensive posture, which is their norm, okay, that's what they were invented for, save the government debt markets, okay? Once they do that, the flow might not go where they want. And I'm strongly suspecting it's going to go to monetary metals. Why? Because as Ray Dalio said, like over a year ago, you know, quit looking at the price of your stock. Look instead at the underlying value of your money unit, meaning the degradation thereof. Jeff Gundlach last week commenting on the Powell's statement said, you know, this they're going to monetize again. They're panicked. And that's, you know, obviously going to, when you monetize, you're going to help the monetary metals. Okay. So these managers are astute and they're aware. And as soon as they get a technical sense from their underlying technical staff that this thing's rolling over, you know, at that point, they'll begin to shift more and more. Well, look at the gold mining sector. It's so tiny that it wouldn't take, you know, a half a percent of shift from their regular portfolios into that to blow them through the roof. So anyway, I don't think the Fed determines where it goes. They create it, but they don't determine the direction of the flow.
Let's just talk about some of the key levels in the key asset classes that people need to be watching out for as we head into kind of Q1 2024. And take them in any order you like, but let's go through, you know, stocks, bonds, NASDAQ, Dow Jones, S&P, anything you think where there are key levels on the momentum structures that people need to pay really, really close attention to.
Well, I would look at the one that they're cheering the most about, namely the big indices, okay? That's S&P and NASDAQ. And again, on S&P, we've got some trigger numbers that because of the recent rally we've had this quarter, it's raised certain averages a bit more than they otherwise would have been, which means the point of breakage on the momentum chart is also adjusted up in price terms because the market has rallied. So the momentum is up under the market with the structures rising along with the market. So the market's not getting away from the danger points. It's simply adjusting the numbers up. So we've got a number in the low 4,400s that starts to sound the alarm big time. It's based on quarterly momentum. But there's a number around 4,300 that will reassert the annual momentum so negatively that I think the decline could become very aggressive. Now, I'm not saying crash. Crashes are highly unusual in any bear market. Go back over the decades, you'll see that it's rare. Most the 2000 to 2002 low, there was no crash. And yet it was a wipeout. Okay. But it's at 4,400 and then 4,300 ballpark right now. We'll come up with very specific numbers as we near the end of the quarter, end of the year. That, well, we're 47 something. So you do the math, you know, it's single digit percent drop. You can't afford to sneeze And I'm going to start to blow stuff out that if you saw the annual momentum chart of the S&P, if it got back down to around 4,300 next year, you'd scream. Now, you won't do it on a price chart. Doesn't break anything. But a momentum, it says, it's a triple bottom breakout. I'm going to collapse. So those are levels where we suddenly upturn all this soft landing nonsense. And where everybody who's made their bet based on that assumption over the last year or so and is now very happy, that is if they bought the front end of the S&P, they're going to suddenly be very sour. That creates emotion. Emotion creates panic. And you rush to wherever it's doing best. And, you know, I think gold miners will be one of those places and gold too. So that's the way I see it shaping up. Now, the sectors that will perform worse are likely to be the sectors that outperformed, meaning tech. Now, you know, the AI talk now, it's an overlay, a duplicate of the dot-com talk. I remember in 2000, it's going to change the world. Well, it's true. In more ways than they could even imagine, it changed the world, the internet. Well, AI may change the world too, but that doesn't mean it can't have a major bear market because it's overdone too fast, too soon, just like the dot-com stocks. So yes, the fundamental statement is true, but the technicals aren't in line. So yeah, that'll probably lead the way down. And I strongly suspect that commodity-related stocks, which often do not correlate well to the S&P anyway, I'm talking grain-related stocks, base metals, monetary metals, food producers, et cetera, those could behave quite differently because I think there's another wave up in the commodity sector, the Bloomberg. And that will definitely positively impact commodity-related stocks. So that'll be a better place to be.
What will drive that, Michael? Because obviously there's a lot of people looking at the commodities. They're looking at them as a kind of alternative to the dollar. They're looking at them as an alternative to stocks. But also we've got this spectre of recession in the background. And there are a lot of people saying we're about to go into a bear market for commodities because there's going to be a global recession. What is it that's driving that momentum of commodities, do you think?
Monetary degradation and asset allocation into areas that look less risky, more rewarding. Now, look at, okay, we hear this story about commodities, but never before seen this kind of inflation year over year. Yeah, that may be true. But then again, look at the price of the Bloomberg. It's trading either side of 100 right now. It's bull market peak weeks after the war started, by the way, Ukraine-Russia war. That didn't cause the move. In October 2020, we said there'd be a commodity explosion. You could have thrown a dart at this commodity or that commodity and made a ton of money. They all went up at once. So it wasn't commodity specific. Okay. Oil led the way, but also grains went up big, sugar, cocoa, you name it. They all went up, copper, et cetera. They all peaked in March of 2022, literally weeks after the invasion began. Now, the government blamed it on, it's caused by the Russia problem with grains in Ukraine and the oil situation. It's all caused by the war. Baloney. The move had already occurred. But go back and look historically at the price of where the Bloomberg's been as an asset. Right now, it's at 100. In 2008, it was at 237. Okay, we're less than half where we were in 2008. And 2011 made a secondary high that happened to be coincident with gold at that time. At 170, talking something that's trading right now today at 99, and look back at that asset category over the last 15 years or so and tell me that it's overvalued. So it made a low in 2020, just below 60, went up to 140, pulled back to under 100. And for 10 months now, the Bloomberg has been doing effectively nothing and arm wrestling sideways. Yes, capped off. We've got some key numbers that will trigger the next up wave in Bloomberg. And I think it'll happen in the next quarter. And it won't take but a couple percent up move in Bloomberg from where it is right now to trigger those momentum levels. But again, those who think that commodities must go down during a recession, go back and look historically. Remember stagflation in the 70s? Well, commodities exploded in the late 70s while the stock market was a wasteland. Now, they didn't explode as much as gold did, the 79 through 1980, for example. But they had a huge move, and yet it was a stagflation world. Don't try to make that connection. Look at the relative pricing versus history. They're very, very cheap.
Okay, what about bond market levels going into 2024? Because obviously that's been probably the big story of this year, the volatility in the bond market.
I don't have any specific levels except to say that when we put out a buy signal a couple months ago, TLT, for example, was the one we were using. That's the ETF of the 20-year plus bonds, okay? most people don't go buy T-bond futures, okay? We watch T-bond futures, which is 30-year in TLT. But in TLT, we said when it hit 85, buy it, it's gone. It's now trading at 99, 7-8 weeks later. This is about where we thought the first level would be, where it'd find some resistance. Ultimately, you should pull back from here probably. So if you're a trader, you probably should cash in. It's been a nice move for a couple of months. There may be more, but I don't think it's going to sustain beyond another quarter or so. And I think it could be a function of the beginning of some flow of money out of the stock market. So, for example, if the S&P were to wobble back off in single-digit percents down to, let's say, 4,400 or so, one of our first trigger numbers, at that point, some of these large doubtful asset managers who realize the underlying reality will suddenly say, okay, then we'll move some more assets out of this category, out of the stock market. And they may favor going back, putting more into the T-bonds, because T-bonds have behaved well over the last couple of months. And they could behave well, but I don't see a sustained upside. I just see this as what we call a major counter trend rally in T-bonds or a dip in yields. And not something that's going to last for years, but something that will get people's attention for another quarter or so, particularly if the stock market starts to weaken, is that, you know, the 60-40 thing. So move some over into the 40. So I think that could benefit it, but I don't see it as sustained. I see it as more of an intermediate type situation. The one I see as sustained is gold and related, and likely commodities in the wake of that as well.
Terrific. Michael, look, it's been a fantastic hour, as it always is, getting the chance to talk to you. And I'm really grateful to you for taking this time to come and talk to me. But before we close, your work for me is some of the most unique out there. It's certainly been some of the most prescient. So let people have a sense of where they can find out more about what you do at Momentum Structural Analysis, because it's for me, it's such an incredibly useful tool in terms of trying to see the future.
OliverMSA.com, MSA for Momentum Structural Analysis. You'll see some explanation, how our work functions, why it's designed the way it is, some of our history. Under who we are, there's my picture. You had an email address. Send me an email and I'll send you some sample reports.
Folks, you should absolutely take Michael up on that, because the work is extraordinarily unique and second to none. Michael, again, thank you very much. My best to you and the family for Christmas and the holiday season. And let's talk again in the new year.
Same to you.
All right, my friend. Take care.
Thank you, Grant. Bye-bye.
Well, there you have it, folks. As I said at the top of the show, it's always a great pleasure to talk with Michael. And I just find that the work they do at MSA so unique and so helpful. And hopefully that last hour gave you a taste of that. I would urge you to take Michael up on his kind offer. Go to the website, olivermsa.com, drop him an email and get as many samples of his work as he will send you, because I think you'll find once you start digging into it, it is a uniquely useful tool. That's it for me for another episode. It's likely it for me for another year. You never know when a good conversation might arise. So I'll say that we could have another one before the end of the year, but it's unlikely. And with that in mind, before we turn the page again, I'll reiterate what I said at the top of the show. I'm so extraordinarily grateful to you for supporting this podcast, for following my work and the interactions I have with everybody who writes to me, whether it's with praise, criticism, suggestions for conversations. I'm immensely grateful to all of you. So thank you for that. I wish you all the best for the coming year. I think it's going to be a challenging one for all of us, but hopefully we can make our way through it as unscathed as we possibly can. I wish you health, happiness, and enjoyable holiday season, and I will see you all again in 2024. Thanks again so much for listening. Nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets.